Brother Keogh and his wife are down in Hastings with Brother Brandon there this morning, and Grissom's are still gone, and I don't know where everybody else is, but teens got back safely last night after being gone over with the Darlings over to Madison. So, amen. We are going to continue here with the book of Revelation, chapter 2, and you'll recall that we're going through situation with the churches in Revelation 2 and 3, and I have to do the Bible part, since each of those time periods, each one of those churches represents basically a time period in church history. We're just taking a couple of weeks, sometimes 1 week at others, for, you know, to break off from the Bible and actually teach a little bit of church history through that time. I know that there are a lot of things that you hear about church history. There are things, in fact, I have one in the sermon this morning and for church that I heard this week, that I read this week, and somebody said something absolutely stupid about the Bible and just continued straight on and expected everybody to believe it, which I suppose most people do, and, you know, just without even stopping and thinking. And I think that's how, you know, folks are church history. You know, after all, thou art Peter, upon this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. That means the Catholic Church is the Church of God. You know, they're just great, great leaps, you know. And one of the things that church history points out is some things that you really need to know. And so we started that last time with regard to the time period of Thyatira there found in Revelation chapter 3. So we're going to continue with that here this morning. Let's have a word of prayer, and we'll go get started. Father, now we appreciate that when you said you should know the truth shall make you free, that I know that you were talking mainly about the Bible there, Lord, but one thing about the Bible is the Bible bleeds over and intertwines itself with a lot of things in life, and there's an awful lot that we learn even about history and science, Lord, that we have to subject to the Bible if we want to know the truth. And that's the case, Lord, here with church history as well. Unfortunately, they're just like there's a lot of Bible books about the Bible that have been written by lost men. There's a lot of church historians that were just as lost as Judas Iscariot. And so they've been unable to determine some things about the truth, and were not able to see what was a fraud and what wasn't. So we come to you this morning, and we trust that you will give us the truth. We're glad to have the light of Jesus Christ and the Word of God inside of us. And we pray that you'll give us a love for that truth, Father, where we find it. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. We were talking, folks, last time about basically one of the things that Thyatira points out. It had brought up the doctrine of Balaam, you know, in the time period before. And one of the things that's brought up is Jezebel. And along with some other characteristics, you learned that this time frame from about 580 to 1000 AD it has to do mainly, there's just an awful lot of it where the Roman Catholic Church takes the spotlight in that particular time frame, not because they were Bible believers, but just as far as ill, as far as the bad side of things concerned. By the way, during this particular time frame, the Muslims rose up, okay? So you have two of the great scourges on this earth that rose up and became definitive entities like we know them today during the Thyatira time frame from 500 to 1000 AD. We were talking last time about some things about the papacy and about the Roman Catholic Church. And I know that it's not popular these days to criticize Roman Catholic Church too hard. After all this stuff that happened so bad happened so long ago. And it's just sad to me that folks are willing to bypass not just 100 years of history, not just 500 years of history, not just 1,000 years of history, but literally 2,000 years, basically, of debauchery and wickedness and idolatry and witchcraft. And now everything's supposed to be fine without anybody backing up, without a pope saying we were absolutely solid, you know, absolutely wrong. You know, nobody ever goes there. Now, they can remember all sorts of things about, you know, Bible believers and the Salem witch hunts and all that kind of thing. But as far as remembering some of the things about Roman Catholicism, nobody wants to remember. It's selective memory, folks. And I know that a lot of you were Catholics before you got saved, and I know that you're glad that you came out. And I hope that the real truth and import of that and why you came out. And even if you didn't know all of the debauchery when you came out, I hope that knowing it now, that you realize that that was one of the genuinely most important decisions that you've ever made to relieve yourself of being involved with that thing. Now, the Roman Catholic Church is a wicked entity. And it's headed up by a wicked head, the popes. And if you happen to know or think, you know, a pope that was a fine, fine fella, you may be wrong. No, just telling you. And even if a good enough fella inhabited a chair that stands for nothing but witchcraft and idolatry, that's still not good. All right? Now, as far as history is concerned, we talked a little bit last time. You know, what Roman Catholicism did during this time frame was it developed this machinery by which it was able to keep people in line. And in keeping people in line, they brought upon themselves and brought upon Europe what's known as the Dark Ages. Folks, whether you may not like the evaluation, and you can think I'm wrong if you want, and we'll never probably agree on it if you do decide that's the case. But I believe spiritually that Roman Catholicism brought on the Dark Ages, all right? Because what happened was the kings of Europe subjugated largely themselves to the papacy. And the papacy's intent during that time frame was literally to keep people in darkness. Folks, they didn't have sense enough to wash their hands. You could have learned that from the Bible. They had no sense particularly of cleanliness or anything else. When the bubonic plagues were sweeping through, they didn't have sense enough to bury the dead. Okay? And the papacy fed on that because they want people in darkness. Now, it escaped them. When the printing press came out in the 1400s, and then subsequent books started being written, and then the Reformation, and so on, and then Christianity came to America, and Roman Catholicism had to follow up Christianity, genuine Christianity, into America. Well, so it is that they don't have quite the hold on the world that they did today. That's why we don't have a dark age situation like we did then. But you can still go to some awfully dark countries. You can still go to places where you can find a darkness that is almost as deep as medieval Europe, were it not for communications and a computer and some people coming in from outside that let just a little bit of light eat through. Folks, you have a country not too far south of here called Mexico, and it lives in many places in absolute third world conditions with absolutely nothing but witchcraft and paganism going on. And they live, you know, within 500 miles of the Texas border, United States of America. So the machinery really got rolling during this time frame. There's a lot of things that were laid in place before that, but the machinery really got rolling. We talked last time about excommunication, where if the bishop gets mad at you, the parish priest, he can excommunicate you. And then you're not allowed to take communion, not allowed to have your kids baptized, right? And that means that not only are you going to hell, but so are they. That brings a lot of pressure on a fella, if that's what he really believes is the case. It can go beyond that because there's such a thing called an interdict that was used, especially by medieval popes all through church history, where he would literally place an interdict, which is basically a broad spread anathema or a broad spread excommunication on an entire nation at times, on an entire province many times, where anybody in that province, the church doors was closed. You didn't get to go confess your sins to a priest. You did not get to take communion. You did not get to be buried in a Catholic graveyard. If you died, you did not get to bring your kids to be baptized, which everybody knows was the way you got to heaven. And that means that for a poor king or provincial governor who wouldn't now tell to the Pope that not only was he getting pressure from the Pope, but now he's getting pressure from his people underneath him. And it's not going to take long for a monarch even to say, okay, enough. You know, I'm going to keep my throne. I can't have the people rebelling out from under me. And that way, the Pope was able to literally manipulate the politics and even who got to be king and who got to stay king in Europe and North Africa and the Middle East for an awful long time. So we were talking about some of that. And during this time frame, even historians, even worldly historians, recognize a 200-year time frame, for instance, from 1850 to 1050, as the midnight of the Dark Ages, morally, okay? There was a time frame of about 75 or 80 years for just for a sequence of popes that sat on the chair that was known where the actual historian's theme or title, subtitle for that particular time frame was called the pornocracy. Not the papacy, but the pornocracy. Or the rule of the harlots. And this is why. Now, I just want to take you through. This is history. This is not by a weirdo right-wing Jesus freak Baptist. This is by a guy named Dave Hunt, which is he's conservative, very mainstream Christian writer. There's things about him, you know, that he writes on other things that I don't agree, but he nails her down very well. All right? Let me read you some stuff. And if you're a Roman Catholic, and I know that none of you here probably are, if you know a Roman Catholic, I don't hate Roman Catholics. I want Roman Catholics to be saved, right? But we do hate a system that binds somebody in darkness, leaves them there for their entire lives, and then happily sends them off to hell, even though they say something different. Somebody that basically merchandises Christian phraseology, Christian theology, if it's useful to her, but never lets the truth shine through, so that somebody thinks they're being born again by taking communion, by baptizing their babies at the right time, and coming and confessing their sins to a priest and doing penance, that is being born again. That's not being born again. All right? Now, let me just read you some things, and I will warn you that some of this gets fairly sordid. I don't mean I'm going to read you anything profane or anything. It's probably good that not kids aren't in here too much this morning. I'm not going to get off into, this book doesn't get into anything profane or anything, but it's, let's just say it's very frank. Okay? Now, let me see where I'm going to begin here. The fact is that priestly celibacy has hardly ever worked. In the view of some historians, it's probably done more to harm the morals than any other institution in the West, including prostitution. The proof of the harm done by celibacy comes not from bigoted anti-Catholic sources. On the contrary, it includes papal and counselor documents and letters of reforming saints. They all point in one direction. Far from being a candle in a naughty world, priestly celibacy has been more often than not a stain on the name of Christianity. This teaching developed as an integral part of the evolving papal system and gradually became essential to it. The concern was not morality. For celibacy proved to be a veritable cornucopia of evil. In fact, the rule of celibacy was not the prohibition of sex, but of marriage. Pope Alexander II, for example, refused to discipline a priest who had committed adultery with his father's second wife because he hadn't committed the sin of matrimony. The sin of matrimony. That was the great evil which had to be eliminated for the priesthood to be totally devoted to the church. All down through history, not only priests and prelates, but popes as well had their mistresses and visited prostitutes. Many were homosexuals. No member of the clergy was ever excommunicated for these reasons. But thousands have been put out of the priesthood for the scandal of getting married. Why then the strict insistence upon celibacy? Even to the present day, if it really doesn't mean even to the present day, it really doesn't mean the abstinence from sex. It's because the rule of celibacy has a very practical and lucrative result for the church. It leaves priests and especially bishops and popes without families to whom to bequeath property and thereby impoverish the church. The clergy have no heirs. Pope Gregory VII, bemoaning the difficulty in stamping out marriage among priests, declared this: "The church cannot escape from the clutches of the laity unless the priests first escape from the clutches of their wives." It was considered absolutely necessary to the perfect working of the papal system that there should be organized a compact body of ecclesiastics destitute of all the generous sympathies which grow alone out of family relation, that they might be the better fitted to do the work of the popes. Very few, if any, Catholics realize that as late as the reign of Gregory, which was from 1073 to 1085, it was accepted for priests to be married, and to supposedly live in celibacy with their wives. Okay? Now, this is a system, it says here, that was made for prostitution. So let me read you about some of these popes, okay? If you happen to think that Pope John Paul was a fine fella, I think you're wrong. If you happen to think that the present pope, which one is he now? Benedict the 16th, as different from the 13th, 14th, or 15th. But that he's a fine fella. And I think you're wrong. And I'm not saying that these guys are doing all that these guys do. But I don't know that they're not either. For centuries, the priesthood was largely hereditary. Most priests were the sons of other priests and bishops. More than one pope was the illegitimate son of a previous and supposedly celibate pope. For example, Pope Silverius, this is in the 500s, was fathered by Pope Hormisidus, and John the 11th by Sergius, of his favorite mistress, Marozia, to whom we refer a little bit later. Among the other illegitimate children who ruled the church were Pope Boniface, the first, Galatius, Agapetus, and whatever. There are more. Adrian the 4th was the son of a priest. No wonder Pope Pius the 2nd said Rome was the only city run by bastards. Like I said, there's some frank talk here, okay? Pius himself admitted to fathering at least two illegitimate children by different women, one of them married at the time. The rule of celibacy literally created prostitutes, making Rome the mother of harlots, as the Apostle John foresaw. And his fiery sermons, Savonarola of Florence, Italy, soon to be martyred, called Rome, quote, a harlot ready to sell her favors for coin, and accused the priests of bringing spiritual death upon all their piety consists in spending their nights with harlots. He cried, 1,000, 10,000, 14,000 harlots are few for Rome, for there both men and women are made harlots. This guy, Savonarola, was a reforming priest. He was a Catholic himself, but hated what the Catholic Church stood for with respect to these things. So Pope Alexander IV threatened to lay an interdict on Florence, Italy, if they didn't give up Savonarola. And the men of Florence decided that they would rather kill Savonarola themselves. So they tortured a confession out of him and had him killed. Visiting Germany in the 8th century, St. Boniface found that none of the clergy honored their vows of celibacy. He wrote to Pope Zachary, young men who spend their youth in rape and adultery were rising in the ranks of clergy. They're spending their nights with various women and getting up in the morning to celebrate Mass. Bishop Ruthurio complained that if he excommunicated unchaste priests, quote, there would be none left to administer the sacraments except boys. If he excluded bastards, he said, as canon law demanded, not even boys would be left. Now, folks, I'm not doing this so we can use bad words in church. This is not just an apostate system. It is an abominable system. And it's respectable because of marketing techniques and spin control. Okay? Once in a while, stuff gets out, and we had what some people consider, a catastrophe in the Catholic Church with all the pederasty going on among and pedophilia going on amongst the priests and so on. It's a terrible thing, a horrible thing, the homosexuality and so on. Folks, it's just the tip of the iceberg. That's just the stuff that leaks out through the boards. Here's some examples of some of the popes that ruled. John the 12th, he reigned from 950 roughly to 975 or so, became pope at age 16, ran a harem in the Lateran Palace, lived a life of evil that passes imagination, even toasting the devil in front of St. Peter's altar. Spiritual leader of the church for 8 years, John the 12th slept with his mother, any other women he could get his hands on. Women were warned not to venture into St. John Lateran Church. One of his men, Liutprand, wrote in his journal, Pope John is the enemy of all things. The palace of the Lateran that once sheltered saints and is now a harlot's brothel will never forget his union with his father's wench. Women, fear to come and pray at the thresholds of the holy apostles, for they have heard how John, a little time ago, took women pilgrims by force and did with them as he pleased. St. Peter, Damian's 11th century record of the incredible evils caused by the pledge of celibacy, made scandalous reading that the Pope with whom he shared it preserved it in the papal archives. In fact, it proves that profligacy among the clergy of the time was universal. After 6 centuries of strenuous efforts to impose celibacy, the clergy was a menace to the wives and young women of the parishes to which they were sent. Pope Innocent IV was forced to leave Rome by Emperor Frederick II, who took refuge along with his curia in Lyons, France, upon the Pope's return to Rome after Frederick's death. Cardinal Hugo wrote a letter thanking the people of Lyons. He reminded them they had also owed a debt to the Pope and his court. His remarks provide a glimpse of the shameless depravity of the papal court. Here's what the cardinal wrote. During our residence in your city, where they were in exile while the Pope was in trouble, during our residence in your city, we, the Roman Curia, have been of very charitable assistance to you. On our arrival, we found scarcely 3 or 4 purchasable women. Whilst at our departure, we leave you, so to say, one brothel that extends from the western to the eastern gate. In the 13th century, St. Bonaventure, cardinal and general of the Franciscans, had said that Rome was just like the harlot of the apocalypse. Pope Boniface VIII, up in the 1200s and 1300s, did not hesitate to have both a mother and daughter as his mistresses together. It was Luther's visit to Rome which completed his growing disillusionment with the church. It is no secret that Pope John the 22nd had a son who was raised to cardinal. Pope Sixtus IV turned... I'm trying to skip some here. Well, he gathered more wealth still by charging a tax on mistresses kept by priests. So he taxed the mistresses. Of this period of time, a historian reports there were 6,800 registered prostitutes in Rome in 1490, not counting clandestine practitioners, in a population of 90,000. In Venice, the census of 1509 reported 11,600 prostitutes in a population of 300,000. An enterprising printer published a catalog of all the principal and most honored courtesans of Venice, their names, addresses, and fees. Upon becoming Pope Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia, who had committed his first murder at age 12, cried triumphantly, "I am Pope, Pontiff, Vicar of Christ." Gibbon, historian, calls him the Tiberius of Christian Rome. Though he scarcely pretended to be a Christian, he was, like all the popes, deeply devoted to Mary. Of him, a leading Florentine scholar wrote, "His manner of living was dissolute. He knew neither shame nor sincerity, neither faith nor religion. Moreover, he was possessed by an insatiable greed, an overwhelming ambition, a burning passion for the advancement of his many children, who, in order to carry out his iniquitous decrees, did not scruple to employ the most heinous means." Pope Innocent VIII, like his predecessor, Pope Innocent VIII, Borgia, as a fond father, admitted who his children were, baptized them personally — these are bastard children — gave them the best education, proudly officiated at their weddings in the Vatican, which were attended by Rome's leading families, and then elevated them promptly to cardinals and bishops and to the Curia. Most people don't know too much about the Sistine Chapel, really, as far as the history goes. The magnificent Sistine Chapel, for example, was built by and named after Sixtus IV, who taxed others for keeping a mistress but paid none for his own. Here the cardinals meet to elect the next pope. And that, of course, is where all Michelangelo's work is, right? Admiring visitors are not aware that this, the world's greatest work of art, was commissioned by Julius II, who bought his papacy with a fortune, didn't even pretend to be religious, much less a Christian. Notorious womanizer who sired a number of illegitimate children, Julius was so eaten up with syphilis that he couldn't expose his foot to be kissed. I'm not trying to gross you guys out. If you want me to quit, I will. But ladies and gentlemen, this is despicable. I mean, let the quote-unquote Anabaptists or Baptists have a history like this, and it'd be all over the world. Now, how is it that you can escape 2,000 years of history almost and never hear a peep about this stuff, and that old geezer over there is just the finest thing to ever sit anywhere? How does that work if the God of this world doesn't run this thing? All right. Popes were both installed and deposed by imperial armies at times, or even Roman mobs. Many were murdered. More than one pope was executed by a jealous husband. A hardly apostolic succession. And think about that one. These are all in succession to the apostles, right? Well, yeah, a lot of them were killed by jealous husbands. How does that work? Money and or violence most often determined who would be Peter's successor. No wonder that in the Concordant of Worms, the Pope was made to swear that the election of bishops and abbots would take place without simony and without violence. Simony is buying the office. At times, there were several rivals, each claiming to have been legally voted by a legitimate council. One of the earliest examples of multiple popes. But you didn't know that, did you? I bet you'd never learn that in secular history. That there have been many times during the years that there have been multiple popes at one time. All the successors of Peter, all elected by different bodies of warring factions within the Roman Catholicism, or at least in Rome. And a lot of times these guys did nothing but kill each other until one finally got at the top of the heap and then became pope for the next 15 or 16 years. For instance, one of the earliest examples was created by the simultaneous election of several factions of popes, Yersinus and Domitius. The former's followers managed, after much violence, to install him as pope. Later, after a bloody three-day battle, Domitius, with the backing of the emperor, emerged the victor and continued as vicar of Christ for 18 years. This is an apostolic succession, unbroken. Stephen VII, who exhumed Pope Formosius and condemned the corpse for heresy at a mock trial. One pope digs up another pope's bones, puts him on trial, condemns him, and excommunicates him. The pope that did this was soon thereafter strangled by zealots who opposed him. His party promptly elected a Cardinal Sergius to be pope, but he was chased out of Rome by a rival faction which had elected Romanus as its vicar of Christ. Of the strange manner in which popes followed one another in an unbroken line of apostolic succession from Peter, sarcasm, one historian writes, over the next 12 months, four more popes scrambled onto the blood-stained papal throne, maintained themselves precariously for a few weeks or even days before being hurled themselves into their graves. Seven popes and an antipope had appeared in a little over 6 years when Cardinal Sergius reappeared after 7 years exiled, back now by the swords of a feudal lord who saw a means thereby of gaining entry into Rome. The reigning pope, Leo V, found his grave. The slaughters in the city reached the climax, and then Cardinal Sergius emerged as Pope Sergius III, sole survivor of the claimants and now supreme pontiff. It's a bunch of kids, you know, playing King of the Hill, you know, only it's swords instead of dirt clods. Attempting to establish stability in selecting popes in 1059, Nicholas II defined the role of the cardinals in the papal electoral process. So that's where it's set up now, where the College of Cardinals now elects popes, right? That was supposed to fix the system. It was hardly an improvement. As one 19th century historian pointed out, few papal elections, if any, have been other than simoniacal, bought off with money. It's all money. Not about somebody being a godly fellow or having these credentials that are without, you know, a blot. The invention of the sacred College of Cardinals has been, on the whole, perhaps the most fertile source of corruption in the church. Many cardinals went to Rome for the conclave with their bankers. In other words, prepared to be bought off. Much insight into such corruption comes from the diaries of John Burchard, master of ceremonies at the conclave that elected Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI. Burchard concludes that only 5 votes were not bought in that election. The young Cardinal Giovanni de' Medici, who had refused to sell his vote, thought it prudent to leave Rome immediately because he couldn't be bought. He said, I better get out of here now. In those days, a cardinal's hat sold for a king's ransom. So it took a fortune to enter the polluted stream of apostolic succession. Money flowed in from all over Europe to back favorite candidates. Borgia bought the papacy with villas, towns, and abbeys, 4 mule loads of silver to his greatest rival, Cardinal Sforza, to induce him to step down. Some popes were put in office by their mistresses. 6 popes by a mother and daughter pair of prostitutes. Theodora of Rome, she was the wife of a powerful Roman senator, was most successful at this strategy. She manipulated Roman politics by exploiting the fact that her daughter, Marozia, and by the way, these women are famous in the annals of Roman Catholic historians. These are two women, a daughter and a mother, and there's another sister as well, that manipulated the papal throne for years and years through various popes. Marozia was the mistress of Pope Sergius III, known as the Mistress of Rome. Marozia did not hesitate at murder to accomplish her ambitions. Theodora, the mom, herself was a mistress to 2 ecclesiastics, whom she maneuvered in quick succession after Sergius' death under Peter's throne. She installed Anastasius III and Lando. Falling in love with a priest from Ravenna, she maneuvered him onto the papal, onto the papal throne. The prostitutes determined who would be pope could hardly be apostolic succession. Of this remarkable mother and daughter, Edward Gibbon, famous author. By the way, that's the author of The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, and I always confuse him with Martin Gilbert. I'm sorry. Edward Gibbon. Anyway, this is what he said. The influence of 2 prostitutes, Marozia and Theodora, was founded on their wealth and beauty, their political and amorous intrigues. The most strenuous of their lovers was rewarded with the Roman mitre. The bastard son, the grandson, the great-grandson of Marozia, a rare genealogy, were seated in the chair of St. Peter. Alberic, one of Marozia's sons, with his armed thugs, literally controlled Rome. He made the Roman leaders swear to elect his son, Octavian, not only as his successor to the imperial throne, but upon the death of the pope, so that the supreme religious office as well. And so it happened that Octavian called himself Pope John the 12th, while at the same time retaining the name Octavian as prince of the empire. Thus both the civil and ecclesiastical thrones were joined in one man. John the 12th, this fellow, was obsessed with licentiousness even more than he was with power. Though he had many regular mistresses, they were not enough. It was no longer safe for any woman to come to St. Peter's. Said he was one of his Cortesians tells that the Pope was so blindly in love with one mistress that he made her governor of several cities, even gave her the golden crosses and cups of St. Peter himself. Roman mobs that had supported him and cared nothing about his amorous affairs were angered by the loss of the properties, St. Peter's cups, which Romans had looked upon as part of their heritage. Surrounded by mobs who were now eager to remove him and besieged by the new king of Italy with his armies from without, Octavian abandoned his position as civil ruler but would not give up the even more lucrative and influential papacy, though he made no pretense of being a religious man, much less a true Christian. After his coronation by John the 12th, Otto, the emperor, attempted to lecture the young pope about his dissolute life. John the 12th pretended to heed the advice, but after Otto and his armies had left, the pope, unwilling to abandon his exploits, offered the imperial crown to Berengar, somebody else. When Otto returned with his army to settle accounts with John the 12th, see, they battle back and forth, and the pope sets up kings and then gets mad at the king, and so the king has an army. And so the king comes after the pope, and that happens all the time. Anyway, John the 12th fled from Rome when Otto came to settle accounts to Tivoli with what Vatican treasures he could carry. Otto opened a synod to decide John's fate. Bishop Liutprand presided in the emperor's name and recorded the proceedings. Witnesses were called and the crimes of the Pope established, from fornication to blinding Benedict, his spiritual father, to the murder of Cardinal John, to toasting Satan at St. Peter's altar. But before Otto could execute justice, John the 12th was killed by a husband, by a jealous husband, who was justified in his murder. Yet John the 12th is on the official Roman Catholic list of popes, each known as His Holiness Vicar of Christ. Not long after Otto's death in Germany, the papacy fell under the control of a powerful family of warlords in the Alban Hills. Y'all aren't bored yet, are you? Sorry, this is Breed Along with Brother Kyle, okay? The leader of the clan, Gregory of Tusculum, through wealth and power of the sword, succeeding in placing two of his three sons and a grandson on the supposed throne of St. Peter. The Albericus of Tusculum could eventually boast of 40 cardinals, 3 antipopes, and 13 popes issuing from that one family. It would be a mockery to say that the wealth and power that produced this remarkable familial network of popes had anything to do with apostolic succession. Chased by mobs from Rome in 1045, Pope Benedict IX fled to the protection of his uncle, Count Gregory, whose army controlled the hill country of Tusculum. In his absence, John, Bishop of the Sabine Hills, entered Rome and installed himself as Pope under the name of Sylvester III. He occupied the papal throne a mere 3 months until Benedict stormed back with more swords than Sylvester could summon, ruled as Pope once again. Yet both these men are on the official Vatican list of those considered worthy of the titles His Holiness and Vicar of Christ. Tiring of the burdens of his office and eager to devote himself entirely to his favorite paramour, Benedict sold the papacy for 1,500 pounds of gold to his godfather, Giovanni Gaetano, Archbishop of St. John's Church at the Latin Gate. Giovanni took over the papacy May 1045 under the name of Pope Gregory VI. With fresh resolve, Benedict returned to Rome in 1047, set himself up as Pope once again. So did Sylvester III. Now there were three popes, each ruling over the partition of Rome, which his private army controlled, each claiming to be the vicar of Christ, the possessor of the keys of heaven by virtue of apostolic succession. Growing weary of the charade, the disillusioned and angry Roman citizens appealed to Emperor Henry III. He marched into Rome with his army and presided over a synod that deposed all three popes and installed the emperor's choice. He called himself Clement II. But Benedict was not so easily dispatched. As soon as the imperial army withdrew, he returned to Rome and managed by force of arms to rule as Pope for another 8 months until Henry returned, chased him back to the Alban Hills for the last time. There's a bunch of kids fighting over a sucker. A very expensive sucker at that. Let me just read you just a little bit more. We're almost done here. I guess there's not much of a reason to go to anything else at this point. But to reaffirm, this is a different book. Pope Sergius III obtained the papal chair by murder. The annals of the Church of Rome tell about his life of open sin with Marozia, who bore him several illegitimate children. He was described by Baronius as a monster and by Gregoravius as a terrorizing criminal. Says one of the historians, for 7 years this man occupied the chair of St. Peter, while his concubine and her Semiramis-like mother held court with a pomp and voluptuousness that recalled the worst days of the ancient empire. This woman, Theodora, we talked about her, likened to Semiramis because of her corrupt morals, along with Marozia, the Pope's concubine, filled the papal chair with their paramours and bastard sons and turned the papal palace into a den of robbers. The reign of Sergius III began the period known as the rule of the harlots. Pope John X, originally, these are all different guys than you've read about, heard about before, had been sent to Ravenna as an archbishop, but Theodora had him returned to Rome and appointed to the papal office. According to one who wrote at the time, Theodora supported John's election in order to cover more easily her illicit relations with him. His reign came to a sudden end, however, when Marozia smothered him to death. She wanted him out of the way so Leo VI could become pope. His reign was a short one, however, for he was assassinated by Marozia when she learned he had given his heart to a more degraded woman than herself. Not long after this, the teenage son of Marozia, under the name of John the 11th, became pope. The Catholic Encyclopedia says, some assert that he was the natural son of Sergius III. Through the intrigues of his mother, who ruled at that time in Rome, he was raised to the chair of Peter. But in quarreling with some of his mother's enemies, he was beaten, put into jail, where he died of poisoning. They're murdered, they're poisoned. In 955, the grandson of Marozia, at 18 years of age, became pope under the name of John the 12th. We read about him. Of course, immoral man whose life was such that the Lateran was spoken of as a brothel. Pope, let me see. I'll read that. Pope Boniface the 12th maintained his position through a lavish distribution of stolen money. The Bishop of Orleans referred to him and a couple of other popes as monsters of guilt, reeking in blood and filth, and as Antichrist sitting in the temple of God. The Catholic Encyclopedia says he overpowered John the 14th, thrust him into the dungeon of St. Angelo, where the wretched man died 4 months later. For more than a year, Rome endured this monster, steeped in the blood of his predecessors, but the vengeance was terrible. For his sudden death in July 985, due to all probability to violence, the body of Boniface was exposed to the insults of the populace, dragged to the streets of the city, naked, covered with wounds, flung under the statue of Marcus Aurelius, and the following morning, compassionate clerics removed the corpse and gave it a Christian burial. Pope Benedict XIII bought the office of pope with open bribery. The following pope, John the 19th, also bought the papacy. Being a layman, he was just a layman, it was necessary for him to be passed through all the clerical orders in one day. Benedict the 9th was made pope as a youth, 12 years old, through a money bargain with the powerful families that ruled Rome. He committed murder in broad daylight, robbed pilgrims on the graves of the martyrs. He was a hideous criminal, and the people finally drove him from Rome. King Henry III appointed Clement II as the pope because no Roman clergyman could be found who was free of the pollution of simony and fornication. Innocent III surpassed all the predecessors in killing. He did not kill them personally, but he established the Inquisition, in which it was estimated that as high as 1 million people were tortured to death. Okay, that's enough. So, folks, this thing is a mess. And what's a sad thing is somewhere, you know, this world has to be run by some entity that's greater than just the media, because I don't know how you escape, you know, facts like this and still consider it at very worst, a harmless and helpful organization. It's just not. Okay? And so thus it is with the popes. I got some more to tell you here next week. Any questions or comments at the moment? Go ahead, Brother Steve. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they haven't changed. Like I said, the political situation's changed, and maybe they couldn't get away with what they got away with in the Dark Ages because they were, you know, on top. But it's still wretched. Any other questions, comments, anything? Okay, I guess we'll quit a little early and take a little break here this morning.